caliber of weapon being used against me, or the location of the shooter, or even pause to establish that I was really the target, and not just a hapless intercessionary. I ran very quickly towards the shadowed base of the nearest building. I resisted the perfectly sensible flight reflex which told me to throw my suitcase away, knowing that without it I would quickly sink into the anonymity of the mulch. If I lost it, I might as well offer myself up to be shot. The gunfire chased me. I could tell from the way each shot landed a meter or so behind my heels that the person shooting at me was not lacking in skill. It would not have taxed them to kill me. They would have needed only to advance their line of fire fractionally, and I recognized that their marksmanship was more than sufficient. Instead, it suited them to play with me. They were in no hurry to execute me with a shot in the back, though it could have been achieved at any point. I reached the building, my feet submerged in water. The structure was slab-sided, no little indentations or crannies in which I could secrete myself. The gunfire halted, but the ellipse of the spotlight remained steady, the shaft of harsh blue light making curtains of the rain between me and the cable car. A figure emerged from the darkness, clad in a greatcoat. At first I thought it was either the man or the woman I had spoken to earlier. But when the man emerged into the spotlight, I realized I hadn't seen his face before. He was bald, with a jaw of almost cartoon squareness, and one of his eyes was lost behind a pulsing monocle. "Stand perfectly still," he said, "and you won't be harmed." And his coat flapped apart to reveal a weapon, bulkier than the toy gun which the canopy woman had carried, somehow more serious in intent. The gun consisted of a handled black rectangle, tipped with a quartet of dark nozzles. His knuckles were white around the grip, his forefinger caressing the trigger. He fired from hip height. Something buzzed out of the gun towards me, like a laser beam. It connected with the side of the building with a fizzle of sparks. I started running, but his aim was surer the second time. I felt a stabbing pain in my thigh, and then suddenly I was no longer running. Suddenly I was doing nothing except screaming. And then even screaming became too hard. The medics had done very well, but no one could be expected to work miracles. The monitoring machines crowding around his father's bed attested to that, voicing a slow and solemn liturgy of biological decline. It was 6 months since the sleeper had awakened and injured Skye's father, and it was to everyone's credit that they had kept Titus Houseman and his assailant alive until now. But with medical supplies and expertise stretched to breaking point, there had never really been any realistic prospect of nursing both of them back to health. The recent series of disputes between the ships had certainly not assisted matters. The troubles had intensified a few weeks after the sleeper had awoken, when a spy had been discovered aboard the Brasilia. The security organization had traced the agent back to the Baghdad, but the Baghdad's administration had declared that the spy had never been born on their ship at all, and had probably originated on the Santiago or the Palestine all along. Other individuals had been fingered as possible agents, and there had been cries of wrongful imprisonment and violations of flotilla law. Normal relations had chilled to a frosty four-way standoff, and now there was almost no trade between the ships. No human traffic, except for despondent diplomatic missions, which always ended in failure and recrimination. Against this backdrop, the requests for more medical supplies and knowledge to help nurse Skye's father had been shrugged aside. It was not, they said, as if the other ships did not have crises of their own, and as head of security,